L-E-T-E-N-E-T.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 100% match on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Hey, I'm Steph, and this is Not Today. Hello and welcome. Before I jump into our case today, I wanted to let you know that bonus episode number 51 is out now over on our Patreon. Alex and I are talking about the 1993 Kamar Dabin incident, which involved the mysterious and violent deaths of six Soviet hikers in Siberia's Kamar Dabin mountain range, with one survivor, Valentina Udachenko. This is an extremely strange case and has been compared to the Dyatlov Pass incident, so if you want to hear about that case or 50 other bonus episodes, head to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. But without further ado, let's get into our story of the day. This case contains graphic details that may be distressing to some. Listener discretion is advised. Today, I'm going to be telling you about one of the most famous Black Widow serial killers of all time. The Black Widow spider is the most venomous spider found in the US. However, it's not their level of poison that inspired the title Black Widow Murderer. Instead, it's because on occasion, these female spiders will eat their male counterparts after mating. A Black Widow serial killer is a female murderer who kills multiple partners, such as husbands, lovers, or family members, over an extended period, typically driven by financial gain. This type of killer often uses covert, methodical, and quiet methods like poisoning rather than violent, physical confrontation. Judy Buonanno's main method of murder was poison, but as time went on, she resorted to much more violent methods. And ultimately, her criminal career resulted in her becoming the first woman executed in Florida in 150 years, and the first to die in the state's electric chair. But now that we know how this case ends, why don't we take it all the way back to the beginning and see how she got there? Judy Buonanno was born Judias Anna Lou Welty on April 4, 1943 in Quanah, Texas. Her mother passed away from tuberculosis when she was only two, and her father was a farm worker. She was the third of four siblings, but sources only name one of her brothers, Robert. Judy and Robert were separated from their other two siblings after her father put them up for adoption, and they ended up living with a different family for a while until their maternal grandmother took them in. So from a very early age, she was dealing with rejection and abandonment, and it was during her time in the system that Judy claimed she was sexually abused. Her father remarried and moved to Roswell, Texas, with his new wife and her two children. And then at that point, reclaimed Judy and Robert from their grandmother when Judy was 10 years old. But this change definitely wasn't a happily ever after for these children. This was a far cry from a stable and loving environment. Abuse and neglect were a large part of their lives moving forward, and Judy and Robert suffered the worst of it at the hands of their father and stepmother. According to Judy, she was starved, burned with cigarettes, and treated as a slave, forced to carry out the household chores, and was told if she didn't do the required cleaning well enough, she'd be forced to sit in a corner and watch the rest of her family eat their dinner while she went without a meal. They also began physically beating Robert around this time. Not just his father and stepmother, but also their stepbrothers. And on one occasion, Judy snapped and fought back and threw hot grease on her stepbrothers and flew into a frenzy of punching, kicking, and throwing anything she could get her hands on, which landed her in jail for 60 days at the age of 14. During the fight, her father had called the police on her, and she was the one arrested for assault. I'm not saying she shouldn't have been arrested for throwing hot grease on her stepbrothers, but it seems like she wasn't the only one who should have been arrested. At the end of the 60 days, Judy didn't ask to be returned to her father and stepmother's home. She said the opposite. She told them she didn't want to go home at all. She was also furious with her younger brother Robert and wanted nothing to do with him either, saying, quote, "I wouldn't spit down his throat if his guts were on fire." I'm not quite sure what prompted that hatred toward her brother, but It was obviously there. And after that, she never saw her family again.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 100% match on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Upon release, Judy chose to attend an all-girls reform school called Foothills High School in Albuquerque, where she graduated in 1959 at the age of 16. And now out on her own in 1960, Judy moved to Roswell to study at Eastern New Mexico Medical Center and began working as a nursing assistant. Despite being fresh out of high school and 16 years old, Judy told her coworkers that she had already gone to nursing school on scholarship, which was a blatant lie. But that would be a hallmark trait of Judy Buonanno. She was no stranger to a big fat lie to make herself look better or to just spice up her life, I think. Around this time, she also met and hit it off with a man named Arthur Leroy Schultz, and they began dating. She and Arthur Schultz never got married, but she decided that she would take his name and become Anna Schultz. So not even Judy, she just completely changed her name. And at the age of 17, Judy became pregnant, and on March 30th, 1961, she gave birth to her son, Michael Arthur Schultz. And Arthur decided he wanted nothing to do with Judy and definitely didn't want to be a father, so he left her. And Judy ended up being a single mother at only 17 years old. On the outside, to the people in her life, she seemed to be a normal person. She wanted to raise her son well and provide for him. But in reality, she would do anything she could to manipulate the system or the people around her to get as much money as possible. Her main priority was becoming as rich as she possibly could. And it wasn't to benefit her son, it was absolutely to benefit her. Everything was about Judy. Shortly after the birth of her son, Anna, aka Judy, met 28-year-old James Goodyear, a U.S. Air Force mechanic, while she was working as a cocktail waitress. He was 10 years older than she was, but he was a much more stable and good person than Judy. It didn't take long before Judy and James were married, and she became Judy Goodyear on January 21, 1962. And on January 16th of 1966, Judy gave birth to their son, also named James, and right after that, James adopted Judy's other son, Michael, and changed his name to Michael Goodyear. And she and James apparently had a good marriage for a while. They got along, they traveled, they went out for dinners, and they seemed to have it all. In 1967, the Goodyear family moved to Orlando, Florida, and soon they would have another daughter, Kimberly. And then one day, Judy approached James with an idea. She wanted to protect her family and make sure that they were taken care of if anything ever happened to James. And so she and James agreed to take out life insurance policies for him. Around this time, Judy opened Conway Acres Child Care Center in 1968 and listed James as a co-owner. However, he was serving in the Air Force and wasn't really involved in the business at all. And although their marriage seemed to start out well, it eventually soured, and the couple began fighting a lot. And then James was deployed to Vietnam for about a year. This was a very stressful time for Judy since she was raising their three children alone. But when James came back from Vietnam, Judy and James apparently tried to put their past issues behind them and rekindle their marriage. I say apparently because I don't think that was really Judy's plan, but that's what she told James. 3 months after his tour in Vietnam, he became violently ill. It didn't come on all at once. James first felt sick on August 26, 1971, and then over the course of several weeks, his sickness got progressively worse. James was doing really badly. His organs were shutting down, and he began having hallucinations and convulsions. Unbeknownst to him, Judy decided she was going to slowly poison James, and she began feeding him a concoction of pills containing paraformaldehyde and arsenic. So after James got extremely sick, he began relying heavily on Judy. She was his wife after all, and he loved her very much, and she happened to be a nurse. So Judy was, of course, pretending to take care of James in his terrible, sickly state. And during her treatment of James, she was telling him to take pills that she claimed would make him feel better. He eventually was admitted to a U.S. Naval hospital in Orlando, suffering from what doctors called mysterious symptoms. Doctors were never able to identify the cause of his illness, and he wasn't responding to any of their treatments. It was bizarre. Ultimately, James Goodyear died at the age of 37 on September 15, 1971. His official cause of death was cardiovascular collapse and renal failure. There was no tox screen performed, and Judy claimed James must have died from some chemical they were using on the military in Vietnam. If they had done an autopsy or tox screen, they would have found enough arsenic in his system to kill 15 men. But Judy was never suspected, and they never found the arsenic, so James just died and was buried. Judy and James had been married for about a decade at that point, and so nobody was looking at her to be the possible cause of his death. It seemed like she was a doting mother and wife, and there was no way she could have been the cause. Also, this would be a pretty rare scenario for someone to be poisoning their husband with so much arsenic that it could kill 15 men, so they just weren't thinking that way. But only 5 days after her husband's death, Judy cashed in on 3 different life insurance policies that James had, and in total she received $85,000 from both life insurance and veteran benefits, which would be a lot of money today. But $85,000 in 1971 had the purchasing power of $693,000 today. So this was a humongous payout for Judy. And coincidentally, just after that, Judy's house caught on fire. So she collected an additional $90,000 in insurance payment. So altogether, she made $175,000 in 1971, which is equivalent to approximately $1.5 million today. Needless to say, she was rolling in it. In 1972, Judy moved from Orlando to Pensacola, Florida, and quickly began a relationship with a man named Bobby Joe Morris. It's been speculated that Judy may have already had her sights on Bobby Joe before James Goodyear was even dead, because she was very methodical with her movements. She and Bobby Joe supposedly had a really fun time together, or at least she put on a really good show for him. They traveled, they had nice dinners out, they seemed to be a good couple. But just like her marriage with James Goodyear, her relationship with Bobby Joe eventually deteriorated. They were never officially married, however, Bobby Joe was listed as Judy's common-law husband. And during her relationship with Bobby Joe, Judy began really mistreating her son Michael. For most of his adolescent life, Judy sent him to mental institutions. He had mild intellectual disabilities, which sometimes affected his speech and behavior, but he was institutionalized so often he was rarely ever with his family. And when he was home, Judy forced him to sleep in the basement. Relatives and friends also claimed that Judy referred to Michael as a bastard and an idiot. She hated him. And she eventually sent him to foster care. This was supposedly because the family had lost James's military benefits after his death, and she couldn't pay for the treatments that Michael needed. So she framed it as if this was some great tragedy, and she was an amazing mother who was just doing her best to pay for her son's treatments, and now here he was, ending up in foster care because she couldn't care for him. But Judy had a ton of money after the many insurance payouts she received, so she had either blown through all of this money and had none left to pay for her son's treatments, or she just didn't want to spend a dime of it on him, which is extremely sad for him. In 1977, Bobby Joe Morris decided he didn't want to be with Judy anymore and moved to Trinidad, Colorado. But Judy decided she was just going to follow him there. And Bobby Joe had a really hard time saying no to Judy. So they reconciled and decided they would give their relationship another go. Judy and the kids moved back in with him, but just before she left Pensacola for Colorado, Judy's house once again burned down, and she collected yet another insurance payout. I don't know how she continues to get away with all of this, and how none of this seems suspicious, but apparently it was working for her. She also picked back up Michael from foster care just before they left for Colorado. And at this point, she was using the name Judy Morris, even though that wasn't actually her name, since she and Bobby Joe were never married. And she began opening insurance policies on Bobby Joe, which he never knew about. She was just claiming that he was her husband and using this fake name, and I guess that was good enough for the insurance companies. And she was able to take up policies on him, which is pretty terrifying. And by 1978, Bobby Joe fell ill. He was a big drinker, so Judy assumed no one would suspect anything other than that to be the cause of his health problems. Strangely enough, he was exhibiting the very same mysterious symptoms that James Goodyear had, and he was admitted to San Rafael Hospital, where Judy was working as a nurse's aide on January 4, 1978. And again, doctors couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. The entire time, Judy was the one who took care of him in the hospital, and because of that, Bobby Joe just kept getting worse. He was dealing with hallucinations and tons of pain. Arsenic poisoning is a very painful way to die. It includes vomiting, abdominal pain, diarrhea, numbness and tingling of the extremities, muscle cramping, and ultimately, death. But Judy began telling anyone that would listen that Bobby Joe was an alcoholic. He would drink 2 bottles of vodka and a case of beer a day. And this was all to gain sympathy while also shaming Bobby Joe and giving somewhat of an explanation for his mysterious sickness. Which worked for her, because the doctors at the hospital had no reason to believe Judy was lying. She was their peer, after all, and a trained nurse's aide. So she just continued to feed them whatever story she had come up with, and it really worked for her. She claimed Bobby Joe was just a washed-up alcoholic who didn't take care of himself, so it made sense that he was extremely sick. But unlike James, Bobby Joe made it out of the hospital on January 21st, 1978. After spending almost a full month in the hospital. The only reason he got better after a month was because Judy couldn't very easily feed him the poison pills while he was in the hospital under the supervision of other nurses and doctors. So he got better enough to be released into the loving care of Judy. Only 2 days later, on the 23rd, Bobby Joe collapsed at the dinner table and was rushed back to the hospital. And this time he was even more severely ill than the first time he was admitted. And he died on January 28th from cardiac arrest and metabolic acidosis at the age of 39. Bobby's mother wanted his body to bury him, but Judy told her no, they were going to cremate him. But as I said earlier, Judy wasn't his wife, so she really couldn't make any decisions for him. And his mother immediately squashed that idea, and ultimately Bobby Joe was sent home. And Judy didn't attend his funeral. What she did do the following month was cash in 3 more life insurance policies totaling $23,000. Not nearly as much money as the first time, but it was still significant. It would have been equivalent to around $120,000 today. And once again, Judy posed as Bobby's wife to get that money. She signed documents with the name Judias Morris. Another thing different than James's time around was Bobby Joe's family was highly suspicious of Judy. They believed he was murdered. However, they didn't say anything at the time of his death. Bobby Joe's mother apparently overheard the couple discussing a murder, and Bobby Joe made a strange deathbed confession. It revolved around the fact that Judy was suspected in a 1974 murder case in Alabama. That year, Judy and Bobby visited his hometown of Brewton, Alabama, and during their visit, a Florida man was found dead in a motel room in Brewton. Police had discovered a man deceased in a motel room. He had been fatally shot with a .22 caliber gun, and his throat had been slashed for good measure. And the Brewton police never found any fingerprints, no bullet, no murder weapon, and no suspects. So she got away with it once again. But Bobby Joe's mother overheard Judy telling Bobby, quote-unquote, the son of a bitch shouldn't have come up here in the first place. He knew if he came up here, he was gonna die. And on his deathbed, he blurted out, quote, Judy, we never should have done that terrible thing. So according to Bobby Joe's mother, Judy and her son were involved in the murder of an unnamed Florida man. And then Bobby admitted to it on his deathbed, which made his mother extremely suspicious of Judy, because she knew that she was now capable of murder and now her son was inexplicably dead after coming down with some mysterious illness that made no sense whatsoever. But it seems like she never said anything, because on May 3rd, 1978, Judy legally changed her name and her 2 youngest children's last names to Buenoano, which is a mistranslation of Goodyear in Spanish. She did this as some sort of weird tribute to James. However, in reality, it was probably just funny to her that she was somewhat taking the last name of her very first victim. L-E-D-E-N-E-C!
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 100% match on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
And in June of 1978, she and her children moved back to Pensacola, Florida, now with their new identities. And they could start fresh. In Pensacola, Judy was hired as a clinical physician at a rehab center. Unsurprisingly, she lied about her credentials to get this job. She claimed she had a PhD in psychology and assumed the title of Dr. Judy Buenoano. She also told friends and coworkers that she was of Apache descent, claiming she was the great-great-granddaughter of Geronimo, one of the most famous Native Americans in U.S. history. And just to sprinkle another lie in there, she also lied about how James Goodyear died, saying that he died in a plane crash. So these are some really grandiose lies. She just made these wild claims about her life to make herself look as interesting as possible, and I guess to make her feel good. She was absolutely a compulsive liar and came up with these massive lies for some reason, even though it kind of made her stand out a little bit. You would think a murderer would want to keep a low profile, but not Judy. She was having fun with it. But she could have been having more fun, because Michael was still a pain in Judy's side. As I said earlier, Judy hated Michael. She was ashamed of him, even though he was constantly trying to do things to win her affection. He loved her, but she didn't care for him at all. The year after they moved, Michael dropped out of high school to join the army at 18 years old, which was likely another attempt to gain the approval of his mother, since his father had been a military man and he knew that she liked military men. So he was following in his deceased father's footsteps. He was assigned to Fort Benet in Georgia. And once he was in the army, he went to water purification school. He came home for Thanksgiving, and not long after that, he became very ill. And he was diagnosed with arsenic poisoning. And Judy blamed the army for this poisoning, claiming where he had been working was responsible for this. She said that in the water purification, he was using arsenic, and that's why he had been exposed to it and was now poisoned. Michael survived this poisoning, but the sad thing was they couldn't do anything to reverse the damage that had already been done. 6 weeks after the first exposure, his arms and legs atrophied so much that he couldn't walk or use his hands. So beginning in January of 1980, Michael underwent 3 months of physical therapy, and he was then transferred to Tampa for long-term physical therapy and occupational therapy for what they called, quote, profound heavy metal neuropathy, a degeneration of nerves outside the spinal column, which left him with no nerve or muscle function below his knees or elbows. As arsenic is consumed, gravity pulls it down to the lowest part of the organism that it's affecting. So in this case, Michael's lower extremities. It appeared that Michael had been poisoned over a long period of time, but in small doses. But the body can't clear or metabolize heavy metals, so it built up in his body over time. And if he had continued to consume arsenic, he would have died of multiple organ failure. Instead, he essentially became paraplegic, and because of that, he was unable to return to his career in the military, which was extremely depressing and very difficult for Michael. Judy contacted the military and told them they needed to honorably discharge Michael and send him home to her. So Michael was officially discharged, and Judy committed to taking him to long-term rehabilitative care in Pensacola. She claimed she spent almost $40,000 in home alterations to prepare for his return. She went to the VA hospital in the beginning of May 1980 in Tampa to pick Michael up. Just before he left, his doctors gave him heavy metal braces to support his limbs, and apparently the gear that was fitted to him was almost 60 pounds. He was warned by his doctor that he would need to make adequate safety provisions if he ever planned to go out on the water, because he could no longer swim, and these heavy metal braces would just pull him down. But on May 13th, only a few days later, Judy took Michael, James, and Kimberly canoeing on the East River near Milton, Florida. It was a beautiful day, and Judy supposedly wanted to go out on the water with her family. Kimberly decided to stay on the shore and fish from there. But Judy, James, and Michael would go out onto the water and begin fishing between 10:30 and 11 a.m. Michael sat in a small lawn chair on the boat, which was not secure at all. This was like one of those old rickety lawn chairs from the 80s. It wasn't even like a good lawn chair like we have today. And I really wonder what Michael thought of all this. I'm sure he was terrified, but like I said earlier, he wanted to do whatever he could to make his mother happy. And I have to wonder if this was one of those things. James later testified that when they were about a mile upriver from the bridge at about 2 p.m., the canoe tipped over. Judy quickly swam over to James to save him, but claimed she didn't have time to save Michael, who drowned because of the heavy metal braces on his arms and legs. James was unsure how the canoe capsized, but Judy claimed at some point, James's fishing line got caught on a tree branch, which broke and landed in the boat. And on this tree branch was a snake. So with a snake in the boat, they all freaked out, and that caused the canoe to tip over. But Michael, who was weighed down by his 60-pound braces, immediately sank. But that was only one version of the story. Judy later claimed the boat hit a submerged tree stump, making no mention of the snake or the fishing line. She also claimed that Michael was wearing a life jacket, though no life jacket was found on or around his body. There was a witness, a man named Ricky Hicks, and he also gave a statement and later testified. He had gone fishing between 2 to 2:30 p.m., and he was the one that retrieved Judy and James from the river after the accident. He testified that he had seen an overturned canoe and an ice chest floating in the river. He said Judy told him she quote-unquote lost the other boy. But she also told the man that it was useless to go back for Michael, which was an insane thing to say. She basically told him, "Don't even waste your time on my severely disabled son." Hicks stated that Judy really only seemed concerned about James. But somehow, this whole incident was only looked at as a tragic accident. The current was slow that day, so the canoe and other debris really didn't move much. And a rescue squad diver testified they found Michael's body 3 hours later. He hadn't moved far from where Judy said the accident occurred. And Michael's death was ruled accidental, which is extremely shocking. I said it earlier, but I really don't know how she managed to get away with all of this for this long. She's got a trail of mysterious deaths following her, and yet nobody suspected her of anything. Except Bobby Joe Morris's mother, but she didn't really make any issue of it. She didn't tell anyone, and nothing came of this. Unsurprisingly, it was not long at all before Judy cashed in once again on a life insurance policy that she had taken out on her son, and she got money from the military insurance. She had about 6 policies on Michael in total. Individually, they were all pretty small, but together they added up to around $120,000. And Judy spent this money on vacations and cars, and she opened a beauty salon called Fingers and Faces. She was living a really nice, carefree life. In February of 1981, 9 months after the death of her son, Judy met 35-year-old Army veteran and local business owner John Gentry while at a mud wrestling show at a Pensacola bar. John was described as very tall. He was about 6'3". He was handsome, he had broad shoulders, he was easygoing, and a kind man who had 2 sons from a previous marriage. According to his son, he was the kind of person that commanded respect. John's business specialized in carpet and flooring tiles. He had a huge, really successful store in Pensacola and had several employees working underneath him. So he and Judy bonded over their businesses, since Judy at this point owned her beauty parlor that she bought with the money she got from killing her son. It is so beyond cold, but that's what happened. John had been deployed to Vietnam, but only ended up staying there for 3 days because he stepped on a landmine and was blown up, which he miraculously recovered from. The only injuries he sustained was hearing loss in one ear and a ton of scars. And once again, it seemed like Judy and John had a really good relationship. She certainly really liked how much money he had. They regularly ate out at expensive restaurants, they went on cruises together, and he would spoil her with expensive gifts and clothing. In August of 1981, John and his kids officially moved into Judy's house with her 2 children. And John's kids were excited to meet her. Their father had told them a lot about his new girlfriend, that she was beautiful, intelligent, and well off herself. And the kids liked her. She was nice to them, took them to Disney World. She lived in an upscale neighborhood in a nice house that was decorated really nice and was super clean, and she had a boat. His kids were like, nice job, Dad. You kind of scored on this one. According to John's son, Judy and his father were affectionate in that they would hold hands and occasionally kiss and sit together, but they weren't all over each other. Meanwhile, Judy had been spreading all kinds of rumors about John to her friends, telling them he seemed to be involved with shady characters and had organized crime connections and he was in bad health, just laying the groundwork for him to spontaneously drop dead. The last part was true. He was in bad health, but only because after John caught a cold in late 1982, Judy had begun giving him what she told him were vitamin C pills. But in reality, they were capsules containing paraformaldehyde and arsenic, her favorite combination. She gave him two of the pills every night when they went to bed. It wasn't enough to kill him, but he had begun feeling very sick all the time. John was supposedly aware that they had an insurance policy on him at one point, but according to his son, he was under the impression that Judy had canceled this insurance policy. Once again, I don't really know why or how Judy is the one in control of insurance policies on people she's not even married to, but here she is. She's no stranger to doing this, and I guess she told him that she was going to cancel it, but of course, Judy Buonawano was not going to cancel this insurance policy. That's how she gets paid. This policy was very much still active, but John did not know that. And after weeks of taking these vitamin C pills, John ended up in the hospital for several weeks because he was so weak and nauseated. He recovered after only a few days and went back to Judy's home where they lived together. He said he felt great at that point, but then Judy began giving him the vitamins once again, and he became ill within 15 minutes. He said, quote, I thought maybe there was something in the pills that was not agreeing with my stomach. He wasn't thinking that Judy was doing this intentionally, he just thought that his stomach really didn't like these pills, so he started throwing them away when she would give them to him. He would accept the pills, but then he'd throw them in the trash. And Judy began to notice that John wasn't ill anymore, and asked him why he stopped taking the pills. He said, quote, she told me, if they aren't doing you any good, maybe you should double the dosage. But when John refused that suggestion, Judy didn't say anything. He said, quote, but there was definite anger in her attitude. She was not happy that he stopped taking her pills. John said he saved several of the pills that she gave him and wrapped them in plastic and put them in his briefcase. But later in March of 1983, he became ill again with the same symptoms. This time it happened when Judy cooked John one of his favorite meals, which was Waldorf salad. Waldorf salad is a classic American salad with a base of fresh apples, celery, and walnuts, traditionally dressed in mayonnaise and served on lettuce. Sounds lovely. But almost immediately after eating this lovely salad, John got sick. Judy and the kids were eating with him, however, he had been the only one to eat the salad. And so once he realized how sick he was and that feeling that he had once had before after taking these pills, he stopped eating. That salad sat in the refrigerator for 2 or 3 days until somebody threw it out.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.
L-E-X.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 100% match on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Judy and John at that point had been together for around 2 years, and Judy had some happy news for John. She told him that she was pregnant, and John was ecstatic, and because of that, they decided that they should get married. John, again, didn't know this, but Judy had had a previous tubal ligation and was not capable of getting pregnant, so this was absolutely a lie. Judy had arranged a party at Driftwood Steakhouse because one of her staff members at Fingers and Faces was leaving. It was a going-away party for one of her employees. And she wanted John to come with her to the restaurant to help set up the party. The two would be driving separately, and Judy told him exactly where he needed to park his car in the parking lot. When Judy arrived a little bit after John, she was driving her brand new Corvette and parked it about 2 blocks away in front of a nearby motel. Even though this restaurant fully had a parking lot, she parked 2 blocks away. After the dinner party, Judy walked John to the door and told him that she was going to hang back for a little while longer, but he should go get a bottle of champagne to celebrate her pregnancy when she got home. So John happily walked out to his car, he got in, and when he turned the key and turned on his headlights, his car instantly exploded. Within a second, the car was engulfed in flames and thick black smoke, and parts of the vehicle were scattered all over the parking lot. When the car exploded, Judy came running out of the restaurant with a few of her friends in tow. And when she saw the car on fire having just exploded, she went into a very theatrical fit. She fell to the ground screaming for John and then pretended to have a seizure. John had been catapulted out of his car by the homemade car bomb. However, his shoes remained on the floor of the car. He was literally blown out of his shoes. The blast also tore away portions of his stomach, his kidneys, his liver, pancreas, and his intestines. But he miraculously survived this blast. However, John was in a coma. The fact that a car bomb had gone off in Pensacola, Florida was very strange and very big news. So along with the Pensacola PD, the ATF was also called in for the investigation because, hello, someone's car got blown up. After John had been taken to the hospital, they moved the car to the lot of the Pensacola Police Department. And as it turned out, the investigators were able to figure out that John's car had been rigged with explosives. Pipe bombs had been placed in the trunk of his car. Judy was shocked, to say the least, that John had survived this blast. That was not a part of her plan. And she was likely panicking because all of her lies were about to be exposed. But at the same time, she chose one of the most over-the-top ways to kill someone. So even if John died, how's she gonna explain that one? She absolutely thought she was way smarter than everyone, and at this point, knew that she could get away with murder because she had done it 3 times before. So she was just flying a little too close to the sun, which ultimately is a very good thing because her delusional state, thinking that she is absolutely way too smart to get caught, is what got her caught. When John's kids got the call about what had happened to their father, they were in shock, but they were very happy to learn that their father was recovering in the hospital. It seemed like something you would hear in a movie. His car exploded and he was blown out of his shoes, and now he was alive in the hospital. But despite John being alive, he had sustained a ton of damage. So police weren't able to talk to him for at least a few days. And from the very beginning, Judy had been telling investigators that John was getting threatening notes that were being left on his windshield. He was getting odd phone calls, where the person on the other end would go silent and then hang up when he answered. She claimed he may have been targeted by an old business partner. Once again with the theatrics with this woman, she is really going over the top with her lies. It's also very interesting that she chose this time to like really lie about who it could have been because John lived. So in a couple days when he wakes up from his coma, they're going to say, hey, have you been getting notes left on your car? Have you been getting weird phone calls? Do you have any shady business partners? And he's going to say, no. But again, she really thought she was bulletproof. Before John's car had blown up, she had begun telling her friends that John had cancer and he was dying. Judy thought very highly of herself. She did not think that her trail of lies would be able to be pieced together, and for a long time, she was right. She had done a good job at becoming an entirely new person with each husband that she killed. She would rebuild herself in a way that scrubbed her old life clean. And if she had chosen a different method of taking John out, she likely would have continued to get away with everything she had been doing, and quite possibly never face any justice. Her past was already behind her. Her three previous husbands' deaths had been ruled as accidents, or natural causes, so it was really her decision to blow up John that brought everything to light. Within a few days of the explosion, John had woken up from his coma and was able to talk to the police. And investigators, as I said, asked him which of his old business partners may have had a grudge against him. But John told them that he had no bad blood with any former associates. However, he did give them information they weren't expecting. He began telling them about the pills that Judy would give him. He didn't explicitly say he believed Judy was to blame for the bombing. However, he did think it was odd that all of this happened only a few weeks after he decided to take the pills that Judy so desperately wanted him to take and was very angry that he stopped taking for some reason. Investigators also talked to friends and associates of Judy, and they learned that she had been telling them that John had a terminal illness and would not live very long, which was completely untrue. And they discovered that Judy was not actually pregnant. On top of all of this, they also learned Judy had lost her previous two husbands due to rapid onset illnesses, and her son died in some terrible accident. They also learned from the ATF agents working on the car bombing that they were able to trace parts of the bomb at the scene to a supplier in Alabama, and this supplier was able to provide a receipt of purchase which showed the buyer's name, which was, drumroll please, Judy Buenoano. It was undeniable, bulletproof evidence. It was definitely enough for them to get a warrant. Inside Judy's home, they found wires and other materials which matched the recovered pieces of the car bomb. For someone who thinks so highly of herself, these are some pretty stupid mistakes. They had also gained access to the vitamin pills that John had told them about because he had saved them in his briefcase. So they immediately sent them off to the lab to have them tested. And sure enough, when the test came back, they discovered there was poison inside. Judy had been taking apart whatever capsules these actually were and put the poison inside of them. Paraformaldehyde causes a slow deterioration of the organs, as does arsenic. And as soon as the investigators learned what was actually in the capsules, they knew they were really onto something because that was a class 3 poison. On July 27, 1983, Judy was arrested and charged with the attempted murder of John Gentry. At first, John really didn't want to believe that Judy was the one who was harming him, but as the evidence began to stack, he really couldn't deny it. And part of him already suspected her, because he had been telling the police about the pills in the first place. But that doesn't make it hurt any less. This is the woman he was going to marry and who he thought he was having a child with. John also learned that the life insurance policy he believed Judy had canceled was still very much active, and if he had died, she would have gotten a $500,000 payout, her biggest one yet. Not only that, quite possibly her stupidest mistake yet was Judy had already booked a 180-day world cruise for her and her two kids, but not for John or his kids. Had she succeeded in John's murder, she most likely would have been able to go on for much longer. But at this point, she thought so highly of herself that she had become extremely careless. And once police began putting everything together, they decided to look deeper into Judy's past and found way more than they ever thought they would, which led them to exhuming the bodies of her deceased husbands. They found lethal doses of arsenic in James Goodyear's system. The amount was enough to kill about 15 people, as I mentioned earlier. Bobby Joe had been buried in a cemetery in Alabama where he grew up, as per his mother's wishes. And when they tested his body, he had enough arsenic in him to kill 10 people, which was already enough to get the death penalty for Judy. However, they also exhumed Michael Goodyear's body and found that he also had lethal doses of arsenic in his body. That arsenic wasn't enough to kill him, but it had turned him into a paraplegic. After being released on bail, she was once again arrested in January of 1984 for the murder of her son, Michael Goodyear, and she claimed to be innocent of all charges. Judy was very vocal at her son's murder trial. She even took the stand. She really thought she would be able to talk her way out of it, as so many serial killers do. It's the narcissism. But the jury saw right through her, and she was found guilty of all charges and was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. This was a standout case because her cruelty was unbelievable. Not only had she murdered multiple of her husbands, but she had murdered her own son in cold blood. This type of poisoning was extremely painful, and also, she had taken her disabled son out on the water and killed him by drowning. It was unfathomable. Later that same year, Judy was back on trial, this time for the attempted murder of John Gentry. 39-year-old John Gentry testified against Judy regarding the poisoning and the car bombing. His survival and testimony were critical in exposing her pattern for murdering her partners for insurance money. He told the jury when he told Judy that the vitamins made him sick, she suggested that he take a double dose. As John testified, Judy sat with her lawyers. She smiled and chatted and was wearing a pale blue blouse, gray pants, and chains on her ankles. She couldn't care less. For some reason, John wasn't able to mention the car bombing during his trial, which is wild to me because she quite literally blew him up. I'm also realizing right now that he had survived being blown up twice, because he went to Vietnam for 3 days and then came home because he stepped on a landmine, which blew him up, and he survived that too. So this man is explosion-proof, which is pretty remarkable. He's also been through way too much. Give this man some peace. But to get off that tangent, he wasn't able to bring up the car bombing in his trial, which again is nuts, but even still, his testimony was extremely damning for Judy. Everyone knew what had happened at this point, and they knew how evil this woman was. Jurors also heard evidence about James Goodyear's death and the death of Bobby Joe Morris. Judge Emerson Thompson Jr. ruled that while evidence about the attempted poisoning of John Gentry is relevant to the Goodyear case, knowledge of the bombing would be extremely prejudicial, is what he said. And he was serious. They definitely could not bring up the car bombing, because at one point during his testimony, it appeared that John was about to blurt out about the bombing, and the judge had the jury removed from the courtroom and told John that mentioning the bombing would prompt a mistrial. So he was serious. He was like threatening a mistrial, which would essentially set Judy free. I mean, not really. She had already been sentenced to life, but this portion of the trial would result in her getting nothing for it. One of Judy's employees, Vicki Lewis, also testified, which is when it came out that Judy told her that when John was sick, that her explanation was he was dying of cancer. And on October 18, 1984, she was found guilty and sentenced to a further 12 years behind bars. So at this point, she had life plus 12 years. Despite that, she faced a third trial. This was for the murder of James Goodyear. And once again, she was found guilty on November 26, 1985. And this time, Judy Buonanno was sentenced to death. Her crimes were premeditated and extremely heartless. If anyone ever deserved the death penalty, it was Judy Buonanno. On March 30, 1998, Judy was executed by electric chair in Florida State Prison at the age of 54 years old. At the time of her execution, it had become a big event in the state of Florida because it had been decades since a woman had been sentenced to death. Before she was executed, she apparently became religious and got a few degrees while in prison, but ultimately everyone involved believed Judy got what she deserved. She died without ever saying anything at all about her crimes. No acknowledgement, no confession, no apology. She took it all to her grave. She never apologized because she didn't feel remorse. She was absolutely a psychopath. She treated the men in her life who loved her the most as if they were something that she could trade in for cash, like a used car. She was an evil, cold-hearted killer who would have continued committing heinous crimes if she had not been caught. So what I'm getting at here is good riddance. After testifying against her in 1984, John Gentry largely disappeared from the public eye. And honestly, I don't blame him. He had been through enough, and he deserved some peace. but that is the story of the very evil Judy Buonanno. Thankfully, she's gone. The world is a slightly better place because of it. I'd be interested to know if her children ever suspected her of anything, especially James, who was in the boat with Judy when she flipped it and killed Michael. In one of my sources, I saw that James said that he was unconscious when things went down in the boat, so it seems like he didn't see what happened, but it's very scary to know that he was there with her and I don't even know. Thankfully, he survived, but yeah, nobody was safe around Judy, not even her children. But that is really all I have to say about that. I think I've had enough of Judy Buonanno, so why don't we move on to a bit of a palate cleanser and I can tell you something good, that way we can go on with our days as normal. My good thing is that this weekend it's going to be 70 degrees and sunny. I am excited to soak in some much-needed vitamin D after all the cold and gray, dreary weather that we've had the past few months, at least where I am. And also, I went on a nature walk and the trail that I was on had a ton of flowers planted around it, and it felt like I was truly walking in like a fairy's house. I don't know who planted all those flowers, but they did a very good job. It felt pretty magical in there. And another good thing is that I have officially recorded my second YouTube video. It has been an insane couple of weeks, but I'm really glad that the second video is recorded and I'm going to be putting it out soon. So keep an eye out for that because I didn't plan on taking a few weeks hiatus, but hey, sometimes life goes that way. But anyway, thank you all so much for listening. If you would like to check out all of our bonus episodes, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. You can check out my YouTube video, and hopefully my second one is out now. You can check that out at Steph Today over on YouTube. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival or something crazy that's happened to you and you would like to share with us and possibly hear it on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. I post pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram at nottoday_podcast. We have a TikTok that is Not Today Podcast and a Twitter that is Not Today Podcast, but the TNN podcast is a 3 because that makes sense. And just keep breathing. Yeah.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 100% match on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.